The Church of God the Eternal presents the first message in a new series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, December 21st, 2024.
Today, I am going to begin a new sermon series. This is probably going to be a very long one. I have no idea how long, but we are finally going to do that, which I have mentioned a number of times. Well, there's a lot of potential topics I've mentioned. The one that I'm actually going to begin is a survey of the books of Samuel. So we are actually going to go through 1 and 2 Samuel, the entire, you know, every chapter of both books from beginning to end. Why? My purpose is really, what I really want to cover is the life of King David. So that's my real intent, is to cover the life of King David and to show the specific lessons that in his life made him a man after God's own heart. Start with me in Acts 13, verse 22, because here the apostle was inspired to summarize something that's very key. Here in Acts 13, 22, we find when he had removed him, meaning King Saul, when God removed King Saul from the office of kingship, he raised up unto them David to be their king, to whom also he gave testimony and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after mine own heart, which shall fulfill all my will. So that's a pretty terrific legacy to leave when the Creator God of heaven says at the end of your life, even hundreds of years down the line, that you actually were a man after his own heart that fulfilled his will. So David seems to be unique and uniquely instructive by all that we have in the Bible concerning the things he actually did. So the real intent of this series of going through the books of Samuel is going to be to analyze those specific events in the life of King David that answer that question. But, you know, and I could have just picked out some storylines, you know, and said, okay, here's one thing good David did. Let's read that. And let's read this other good thing David did. And instead I went, nah, it's better to put, I think, it into the full context of everything that's included in the historical accounts around the reign, the rise of King David by God's selection and throughout his life. So then the more I looked at it, the more I wanted to expand it. And then in order to keep it from going completely out of hand, I'll try and limit it pretty much to the books of 1 and 2 Samuel. But if you think we're going to get in, we're going to begin today on 1 Samuel chapter 1, think again. Because really what I feel also compelled to do is to provide a preface to this entire series by talking about the origin of these books, which I'm going to call the Books of the Kings. So I actually want to give you, and a lot of this is taken from human scholarly surmisings, conclusions about the origin, who wrote this one, who wrote that one, and how this one came to be and all of that, which from the outset we have to take with a grain of salt. But I think it is valuable to understand as much as we possibly can about the origin of some of these books that God made a part of his revealed word. But before getting into that, just this reference to David in Acts 13 actually refers back to 1 Samuel 13, verse 14. So turn with me there quickly, and we'll just read the text, one of the texts from which the apostle in the book of Acts was quoting here in 1 Samuel 13, verse 14. But now thy kingdom shall not continue, again referring to King Saul, God's pronouncement on Saul. The Eternal hath sought him a man after his own heart, and the Eternal hath commanded him to be captain over his people, because thou hast not kept that which the Eternal commanded thee. So here we find a contrast. We find in Acts 13, a reference to the fact that God treated David as a man after his own heart who did fulfill his will, contrasted very directly to King Saul, who it says here, because he did not do what the Eternal commanded him. So looking at all the aspects of the life and the times of King Saul as it led into and influenced the life of David, they're pretty intermixed and hard to separate them out, which is why I want to cover all of them. So what were these key decisions in the life of David that made God conclude these positive things about him? So we are going to go through, I want to give you this overview on all of the books. The context of the books of Samuel relate also to 1 and 2 Kings. In what way? They actually don't duplicate the storyline. But what you find is that the first and 2 Samuel still tells the beginning of the story, and as I'm going to show you, then the storyline continues on in 1 Kings and then 2 Kings. So it's really a continual story through those four books. And I'll give you a synopsis of kind of what's a part of each one of them. So when we go back and begin to focus on the books of Samuel, you'll understand those books under the umbrella of all of what I'm going to refer to as the books of the kings. So recall first that these books of the Bible were written by God. Well, yeah, and you might say, well, that goes without saying. But again, I'm going to give you a lot of quotes from human scholars today, like out of Adam Clark's commentary and some other references. And these men, although being religious and believing in the Bible and the truth, very often give you opinions that seem to ignore the idea that God put his hand upon every single word in every single book that we have in these histories. So Romans 3 verse 1 and 2, let me just give you that for context. And this was the basis upon which we were taught in God's true church beginning in the 20th century under Mr. Herbert Armstrong, the significance of the Bible. Now there's a lot of churches, you know, that believe the Bible is the Word of God, but and I don't know what all texts they try and use to prove it, because it's very hard to prove from a book under suspicion that it's legitimate. And in essence, what you find is the belief that these words are the words of God and not the words of a man require faith, the evidence of things not seen. If somebody just believes that all of these books, Old Testament, New Testament, are the writings of men in their day, coming from their slanted human opinion, and in many cases because they each had a political bent or something that they wanted to get down for posterity, who are you going to convince that's not true? So my intent is not to convince the naysayers that the Bible is real and is the Word of God. But one of the evidences we always were taught is here in Romans 3, beginning in verse 1. The Apostle Paul was inspired to ask the question, what advantage hath the Jew? They made so many mistakes. They did so many wrong things, which is what the Chronicles in the Old Testament show. So why the Jews? Why do we care about them? Well, Paul answers the question, or what profit is there of circumcision, meaning of being a member of that Jewish body? Verse 2, much every way. Oh yeah? Why and how? Chiefly, he says, because that unto them were committed the oracles of God. Okay, yeah, but what does that tell us? Well, we were taught that those oracles include two main petitions. And number one is the written word of God in these books that we call the Bible. That written word of God literally was inspired by God through all of these different writers through the ages. And then specifically preserved by God and brought down to our generation. So that God intervened and prevented human beings from besmirching them or in any way affecting them or turning them into error. Because human beings, you leave a human being in charge of it and he will pervert it. So the only reason we have confidence that we really have the inspired word of God that we can count on is because we believe God didn't let a human being mess it up. He literally protected it and shielded it through all these generations for thousands of years down to our day. Again, who's going to believe that? I can't convince you of it. I can't convince anybody that that's true. But that's one of our tenets. That's one of our doctrines. That's one of the things that we stand on. And so we believe the inspired word of God in a written form was a part of this, which Paul referred to as the oracles of God. What was the other major category of the oracles? The calendar. The calendar. Because you can't begin to keep the annual holy days of God if you don't have an inspired calendar that you can count on. It's impossible. So you can read about it, the Sabbath and the holy days, and you can think they're good and want to do it, but there's no way to fulfill it if you do not have a revealed calendar that confirms which days every year truly are the holy days as determined by this Creator. So you got to have the inspired word of God in a written form, which we have, and you got to have a calendar. So we believe we have both of those as part of the oracles, which God preserved through what people? Through the Jews. That's the most important. Besides the fact that God used them as caretakers of the written word and the calendar and forced them to bring them down to us unadulterated, we also have all their misadventures recorded in order for us to learn from. So I'd say those are at least three elements that made the experiences of the Jews worthwhile. All right, so that just to set the stage, because we're going to be going through this survey of two particular of these books, but in all of these books, I just want that reminder. All right, so we're talking about the books of the Kings. And I would tell you that these books, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, and 2 Kings, we can expand it even further. If we really want to be comprehensive, we should include the book of Judges. All right, but I'm not going through Judges, and I'm even not planning to do an expose on 1 and 2 Kings. I'm going to limit it to Samuel, but I want you to see it in the broader perspective. What value are the books of Judges, the books of Samuel, and 1 and 2 Kings? Well, these five books really give a history of the human leaders of the nation of Israel under God. Now, I could expand it and include 1 and 2 Chronicles. Because as you know, 1 and 2 Chronicles is almost like overlays with 1 and 2 Kings. And in fact, there's a lot of common stories. It's almost parallel or like one copying from the other. In reality, you could include Chronicles, which means now we have 5 books. Well, I could also include Joshua. I could include Ruth. Yeah, it could go on. But those that are limited to literally the leaders of the nation of Israel, appointed by God, beginning with the judges, and continuing to the end of the monarchy, you can find within, in essence, those five books, 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings. Add Chronicles if you want, and then the book of Judges, and you got 7. And maybe you like 7 for a nice round number. But Judges 21, verse 25, let's turn there. The last verse of the book of Judges, and it's really a condemnation of the apostate Israelites in that day. Judges 21, verse 25 says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes." Now, that's not to say when Israel had a king, then everybody did what they should do. Because there were a whole lot in the majority of the leaders of Israel, when we get to the kings, then you find that a lot of them absolutely misbehaved and were abominable in God's eyes. But definitely when there was no king, when there was no judge, if there was not a righteous judge under God, it was a very dark period in the days of the Israelite nation. And that was the case as described in the very end of the book of Judges. Hosea 13, verse 9. Let's go there. Hosea 13, verse 9, because there's a very strong comment about this work of God through human leaders for the nation of Israel here. Hosea 13, beginning in verse 9, O Israel, thou shalt destroy thyself, but in me is thine help. Verse 10, he says, I will be thy king. And this is significant. And the point I want to make is that if I give you a quiz and asked you who was the first king of Israel, a lot of people would say Saul, and they would be wrong. Because the very first king of the nation of Israel was God himself. And this is one of the texts that confirms this is how God considered himself. He self-appointed himself over the physical nation of Israel as the first king. He said, I will be thy king. Now, this isn't just, yes, it is also looking forward prophetically to the time when Jesus Christ is going to come back and be King of Kings. But do not just wipe this away in future. It also applied retroactively to the past. God was indeed the first king of the physical nation of Israel. Israel didn't exist as a nation until God made them a nation. They were a people. They were a family. But they weren't a nation. When did they become a nation? At Mount Sinai. And I'm not going back and doing all that history. I'm just kind of hitting the high spots to give you the big picture. But they didn't become a nation, and they didn't have a king until they were gathered together at the base of Mount Sinai. And when they entered into that covenant relationship with God, which was a marriage covenant, by the way, that is when they became a nation. And then Israel, as a wife, not only had a husband, they had a king. And their king was none other than God himself. So if anybody asks you who was the first king of Israel, your answer should be God. Which, and by the way, by extension, was not God the Father, it was the one who became Jesus Christ. So it would also be accurate to say, who was the first king of Israel? Jesus Christ. Because that was the exact personality of the being who talked with Moses, who delivered the law, and with whom Israel made the covenant at that time. That's when they became a nation. That's when they had a monarchy. So he said, I will be thy king. Where is any other that may save thee and all thy cities? And thy judges of whom thou saidst, give me a king and prince and princes. So now is it so that you're absolutely confirmed this is not just a prophecy for the future. This is looking back. And it's referring specifically to the time when God used judges. We're going to talk a little bit about today about who these judges were in order to administer the affairs of the nation of Israel. And in fact, this is a reference to one of the stories involved in the books of Samuel, which we're going to cover in detail. But this gives you the high points of it. Thy judges of whom thou saidst, give me a king and princes. Well, the particular judge they said that to was Samuel. And the first king that came out of that demand of God, which he gave them, was King Saul. Verse 11, God says, I gave thee a king in mine anger, and took him away in my wrath. So that's also a bullet point summary of events that happened and are chronicled in the books of Samuel, in 1 Samuel in particular. So we're going to see the detail of that as we get going. But I'm really giving you to this now so that you understand the big picture of things. God was the first king. Because of the apostasy of the Israelites, they demanded, according to their covetousness, to be like the other nations. We'll see that when we get to 1 Samuel chapter 8. They wanted to be like the other nations and have a king like them. Made Samuel mad because he knew that was dead wrong. God said, Samuel, I'm going to give them what they want, even though it's going to be a curse to them. And it was. We'll see those stories. But from that time forward, God stopped being the official king over the nation of Israel, and it transferred into a human monarchy for the first time with King Saul. But it begs the question, When God was the king, how did things work? Because when you have an invisible supernatural being who's the monarch over your physical nation, how does that work? Well, the answer was, then he did have physical human beings through whom he delegated responsibility for the administration of the affairs of the nation. That was the role of the judges. Well, okay, and this gets, let me read you, then you read what the commentators say about, okay, what constituted a judge of Israel? And I'm not totally happy with the way they put it, but I'll read you one of them. From Adam Clark's, summarizes as well as any of the others that I read. This is confirmation that God was the first king of Israel, administering his reign through chosen human judges, of which Moses was the first and Samuel was the last. So that's an important point. Adam Clark says the word judge is not to be taken here in its usual signification, i.e. one who determines controversies and denounces the judgment of the law in criminal cases, but one who directs and rules a state or nation with sovereign power, administers justice, makes peace or war, and leads the armies of the people over whom he presides. Which begs the question in my mind, then how does that differ from a king? Because the way that summarizes the duties of a judge sounds just like what a king does. So, like, what's the difference? What I would tell you is that what I believe is an inspired distinction between a king and one of the judges of Israel by God's determination. The judges were appointed basically to act upon the instructions that God gave to them and inspired them to do. In other words, answers came from God through an appointed judge. And it did include the administrative things that from a worldly standpoint would look like the actions of a king. But you know all of the examples, and we'll see a number of them, where Samuel, in particular, asked God's instruction. We will find that David did the same thing. Asked God, should I go to war? Should I literally take an army of Israel against this enemy or not? Now, a proper king wouldn't have anybody to ask. He would make the decision. So in that regard, I'm also arguing the fact that there's not a big difference between a judge and a king. Because if Saul and David as kings still asked God, then how is that different from a judge who asked God? I don't know. All I know is the intent seems to have been more active administration by God through the judges. That was the chosen way that God actually set up initially for the nation of Israel to be blessed, not to have a human king, but to have judges who then administered the instructions of God as king. So it gets hard maybe to, you know, distinguish the difference in application from our standpoint. But it's absolutely true, as I've already referenced, that God was highly displeased with them when they asked for a king. Okay, so however you define it, Moses, I would tell you, and there are those then who want to say that the first judges, because if you go to the book of Judges and you say, well, who was the first judge? It wasn't Moses and it wasn't Joshua. And so a lot of scholars will basically say, well, Moses and Joshua weren't judges. I tell you, yeah, they were judges. Because God was the king and he did his work through judges. So he didn't leave a power vacuum physically. The work that Moses did, and I could go back and, you know, show you in the book of Exodus, the examples of the fact that, you know, when his father-in-law told him, hey, you need some helpers. You know, you can't do all of this job yourself, because he was trying to administer, including making judgments to reconcile difficulties and disputes among the people. And he says, one person can't do all this. You need to delegate, which is why he set up this, basically this delegation of 70. And what were they doing? The administrative functions of any nation, including criminal justice system. You know, and the administration of everything that had to be done. So Moses was a judge. And when Moses died, Joshua became the judge of Israel under God, who was their king. Okay? So then after Joshua is when you find in the book of Judges, now you have a chronicle of the events of these individuals. How many of them in total? Well, again, a lot of these scholars will tell you that there were 14 judges in Israel. But I add Moses and Joshua, so I make my list 16. So what I'm telling you is from Moses down to Samuel, you had a total of 16 judges through whom God worked up until the time the first king of Israel was approved by God, which was King Saul. I know a lot of you know all of these things, but just before we get into an analysis of those books, I think it's helpful to kind of have that umbrella information a little bit closer in your mind. What about the timing of the span of these judges? It appears that the total time of the judges is about 400 years. The books of Samuel tell the story of the last judge, who was Samuel himself. So you get, and that's what we'll cover first when we start in Samuel 1, verse 1. 1 Samuel 1, verse 1 is about the life of Samuel himself. All right. So there is the story of the last judge in the line of judges and the transition to a monarchy. All right. So the books of Samuel tell the story of the last judge and the first two kings of Israel, which is none other than King Saul and King David. All right. That's what the books of Samuel cover. That's what we're going to be looking at. These are actually, and you go back to what are the Jews from antiquity really call these books, because the King James was divided up into the book names and the chapters, and all of that was really added much later. There's strong evidence to indicate, again, we can't know for certain because you're dealing with secular history, which may or may not be true, but it appears that originally 1st and 2nd Samuel weren't called that. There's a good inclination that they were literally the first two books of a set of four, which I've already told you, between 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, and 2 Kings, that those were literally all four books in one set called the Book of the Kings. So it's not important whether it's absolutely true or not, but it makes sense to me, and it certainly fits with the content of those four books, that really what you're looking at is the first book of the Kings, the second book of the Kings, the third book of the Kings, and the fourth book of the Kings, covering those four. What about 1st and 2nd Kings in our Bible? And I think it's, again, as I say, very accurate to refer to them as the third and the fourth book of the Kings. Those in particular tell the story of the very end of David's life. So we'll probably, yes, in order to complete the life of David, I'm probably going to go into 1 Kings. But that won't be the focus. That's just going to be to finish out the story when we cover it. So 1 and 2 Kings covers the very end of the life of King David, the life of Solomon and his rise to the kingship in place of his father, the entire reign of Solomon, and then the death of Solomon and the dividing of the kingdom of Israel into two branches after Solomon's death, and also then the book of 1 and 2 Kings then goes all the way and shows the exploits of all of those ensuing kings of the kingdom of Israel to the north and the kingdom of Judah to the south, all the way until every one of them was taken into captivity, ultimately by the Babylonians. So that's the span of the books of the Kings, including those four books, Samuel and those called 1 and 2 Kings. All right, what's some other, I think, valuable background information for us? How about time spans? So again, I've already told you that the time of the judges, that which is chronicled in the book of Judges, and I'm going to extend to the previous reign or judgeship of Joshua and Moses before him, approximately 400 years, okay? What about Saul? Now, Saul was the first king, all right? According to Acts 13:21, he reigned for 40 years. It just says that outright, so that's how we know. What about David? David also reigned for 40 years. We can prove that in 2 Samuel 5, verse 4 and 5. Let's turn there and just read it. 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 4, it says, David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. So, pretty cut and dried. And here, verse 5 gives us a little bit more information about those 40 years. Verse 5, in Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. Now, what's that about? Because this was not a unified nation. And ultimately, then, basically, there were insurrections and divisions that were going on, and it was a hard time for David to come to the kingship, let alone to get a handle on the entire nation in a unified fashion. So he reigned the first 7 years that God considered him a king, only over a limited portion of the family of Israel. All right? In Hebron. And in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. So there was always this cultural, tribal distinction. If you want to think, because of all of these sons of Israel and the distinctions in their personalities and all of that, well, that carried down all these hundreds of years. And they were still there. So there was definitely still a natural division in thinking and allegiance between those that ultimately became part of the southern kingdom of Judah and those that were part of the northern 10 tribes of Israel. There was just a difference. Good leadership could keep them together. Poor leadership saw the splintering that took place. All right. So they were splintered because of the misadventures of King Saul. David, by God's inspiration and through his blessing, actually brought them back into the unity of one family nation. All right? But it didn't happen overnight. And so we'll see the story of how all of those events took place. But the first 7 years, he was literally only the king or the recognized king over, in essence, what became elements of the kingdom of Judah later, and ultimately had to fight in order to gain kingship also over the other tribes of Israel. So we'll see all of that, but it was a 40-year period, including all of those elements. What about Solomon after David? So Saul reigned 40 years. David reigned 40 years. How many years do you think Solomon reigned? Yep, 40 years. We find that in 1 Kings 11:42. 1 Kings 11:42 says, and the time that Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel was 40 years. So pretty consistent in those in the timing of those first three kings of Israel. What about after Solomon? Again, I'm trying to give you the high points, an umbrella description, if you will, for the setting, things I'm not intending, at least at this time, to cover in detail, but I want you to have the overall picture. What about after Solomon? After Solomon, the kingdom of Israel split into two separate entities. The northern kingdom called Israel. Now that can be confusing because they were originally the kingdom of Israel. And after the division, one of those splits was called the kingdom of Israel. But that was, now we refer to them as the northern kingdom of Israel as opposed to the southern kingdom of Judah. The northern kingdom, known as Israel, had a series of kings until its fall to the Assyrians by God's hand, and they speculate that that was around 722 BC, okay, for whatever it's worth. All right, what else do we know about this northern kingdom that was a split off of the kingdom of under David and Solomon because of apostasy? The first king of the northern kingdom was named Jeroboam. He's referred now as Jeroboam the First because there was a later king in the line of Israelite kings also called Jeroboam, so as not to confuse him with the original. We call him Jeroboam the First. Down to Hoshea, who was the last king of the northern kingdom before the Assyrian exile. So just for information, for those of you who care, how many total kings of the northern kingdom were there? 19. And what was their span? So after Solomon died, the kingdom broke up into two different branches, the northern and the southern kingdoms. The northern kingdom lasted approximately 200 years before they went into Assyrian exile and disappeared from history. That's where we, by the way, get our belief in the lost 10 tribes of Israel. They're still there. They're still here on the earth. But they lost their identity. About 200 years after the initial rebellion under King Jeroboam. Okay, so that gives you that. What about the southern kingdom of Judah? The first king after that split was the son of Solomon, Rehoboam. And it was because of his misbehavior that the split happened. And he lost a huge part of his father's kingdom. But what happened to that southern kingdom of Judah? From Rehoboam, the first king of Judah, down to the last king of Judah, who was none other than Zedekiah. The southern kingdom had also about 20 kings. Over what span? Approximately 345 years. In other words, they lasted about 145 years longer than the northern kingdom did. The same thing happened to them all. They all went into captivity because they didn't deserve the blessings of God. But the northern kingdom was worse by comparison. They went into captivity about 200 years after the beginning, after the end of the life of Solomon. The southern kingdom did better. They had sporadically some good kings. So God let them stay as a nation in the Holy Land for approximately 345 years before they went into Babylonian captivity. Hezekiah was probably one of the most renowned kings of Judah. He reigned for 29 years. That was in the later part of that period. You can find that yourself in 2 Kings 18:2. Manasseh, who had one of the longest reigns of the southern kingdom, 55 years he reigned. And by the way, he was a bad, 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 bad king. And yet he reformed. He was one of those that actually, after persecution and tribulation, totally changed. And then God put him back on the throne and he reigned for a total of 55 years. You can find that story in 2 Kings 21. Josiah, another of the very few good kings like Hezekiah, reigned for 31 years. You can find that in 2 Kings 22. And Zedekiah, poor old Zedekiah, the very final one. He was the last king of Judah before the Babylonian captivity, reigning for 11 years. The scholars say up until 586 BC. You can find that story in 2 Kings 24:18. So we're not going through all of that. It's not my intent, but just give you the context of the first kings of Israel, which we will be covering, as opposed to then what ultimately happened to that monarchy. About approximately 345 years or 400 plus years down the line. The Babylonian captivity marks the end of the monarchy of Judah, with that last king Zedekiah being taken into captivity. Thus, from Saul to the Babylonian captivity, what's the timeline? The northern kingdom lasted approximately 200 years. In a parallel fashion, the southern kingdom lasted approximately 345 years. Therefore, considering both kingdoms, from Saul's reign to the Babylonian captivity, we're looking at a span of around 545 years. So from Saul to the end of the monarchy, 545 years. If you add on that, the time of the judges, from Moses up until through Samuel, and the beginning of the monarchy was King Saul, which is 400, 450, you're talking approximately about a 1,000-year period. Not exactly, but in round figures, from Mount Sinai, when Israel became a nation, and God is their king, ruled Israel through the judges, beginning with Moses, all the way down until the end of the monarchy. You're talking about a 1,000-year history, for those of you who might think there's some value in that. So really, that's what we're looking at. If you include the book of Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, and then the parallel accounts in 1 and 2 Chronicles, you're talking, it's short of that 1,000, but you're talking approximately about a 1,000-year history. What about 1 and 2 Chronicles? We're not covering it, but I just want to comment on it so that you understand the value and the distinction of those two books from especially 1 and 2 Kings. Because if you read the Bible, you read 1 and 2 Kings, and then you say, okay, now I'm going to read 1 and 2 Chronicles. And it's like, hey, these are the same stories. Why did God put duplicates of a lot of the same accounts in different books? So I think the biblical scholars have something to be said here. I'll read you some account, including summarized by Adam Clark. Technically, the author of First and Second Chronicles is unknown. I'm gonna finish today by also talking about who wrote the books of Samuel, who wrote the books of Kings. You say, well, they've got Samuel's name on it, so it has to be Samuel, right? Yes, in part, but not totally. But what about Chronicles first? The author of the books of Chronicles is not known. It's not confirmed, and God didn't choose to preserve it for us. But most scholars believe it was compiled by Ezra. I don't have any evidence to say that's not true. And a lot of the suppositions the scholars make, I think, make a good case for it. It is likely, at least possible, that God used the priest Ezra to actually compile the books of 1 and 2 Chronicles. Not only that, there's others. I'll comment on those in a minute. But concerning the Chronicles, perhaps Ezra was assisted, not even by himself, but assisted by the prophets Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, who were all contemporaries, by the way. So is there a reason? Did the scholars just make this up? Why do they think Ezra, with the help of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, wrote or compiled the books of 1 and 2 Chronicles? Why might this have been important? That's another reason. So here's a citation now from Adam Clark's commentary, which I think is valuable, but you decide. Adam Clark records that the real object of the books of 1 and 2 Chronicles is not officially certain, but it is evident that they were not intended as just a supplement to the preceding books, meaning they weren't just copies and retelling of the same events in totality that you find in the books of 1 and 2 Kings. There is a difference. 9 chapters in the Chronicles have extensive genealogical tables, meaning part of the chapters we least like to read, because it's all a list of this one beget this one begat this one beget the other one. Okay? But why would God preserve all of that? There is a reason. But the books of 1 and 2 Chronicles actually contain a lot of just family tree information. Okay? The retelling of some of the same story seems for the purpose of fleshing out genealogy record. I think that proposition has some value. Adam Clark says, the principal design of the writer of the Chronicles, whether Ezra or whoever, appears to have been this, to point out from public registers, which were still preserved in that day, what had been the state of the different families previous to the captivity. That, for what reason? That at their return, when God allowed them after 70 years of captivity in Babylon and allowed a remnant of the Jews to go back to the Holy Land, that they might enter on the and to repossess their respective inheritances. He enters particularly, meaning the author of the Chronicles, into the functions, the genealogies, the families, and orders of the priests and the Levites, and this was peculiarly necessary after the return from captivity, unquote. I think that's a pretty good summary. And if you think about the books of 1 and 2 Chronicles, if they had a separate purpose by God, compared to the books of the Kings, what might it have been? And if you look at it from that standpoint, I think that makes a lot of sense. When did Ezra, if Ezra, with the help of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, actually compiled the books we call 1 and 2 Chronicles? Yeah, the timeline, when did Ezra live? At the end of the Babylonian captivity, and he was part of those who went back to resettle the Holy Land and to be a part of the reconstitution, the rebuilding of the temple. That's found, by the way, in the book with his name on it. We've got a book called Ezra and one called Nehemiah. That tells the story of the captives who return by God's blessing to take possession again of their inheritance in the Holy Land. And number one, to rebuild Solomon's temple that had been totally obliterated by the Babylonians. And two, then to rebuild the city of Jerusalem, which really happened under Nehemiah, who was more the civic leader appointed by the Persian Empire, whereas Ezra was a priest. So the focus of Ezra himself as a personality was to come back and to reestablish the function of the religious worship, especially with the rebuilding of the temple and restarting the temple worship. Whereas Nehemiah came in as a civic leader and was responsible for rebuilding the wall around and giving back the civic independence, if you will, from the enemies around Israel. Okay, so those were the differences, but you find that in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, the post-captivity return. But, so what does that have to do with the books of Chronicles? Well, in all likelihood, the books of Chronicles were compiled, put together, came into being during that same period, at the end of the captivity in Babylon and after their return. So if it's true that the purpose of those books was to document the family tree history of all these different tribes and the priests and the Levites, then it had a reason, didn't it? Because what was the big part of what God gave to Israel when he first brought them into the promised land under Joshua? Wasn't it land? Every family in every tribe was apportioned an estate, a wealthy plot of land in perpetuity. Well, after they've been in captivity for 70 years and totally destroyed as a nation, and now God's going to bring them back, how do you make order of that? It makes sense that somebody kept the history of the family trees so that rightful heirs could retake their rightful family property. And that's where you find the battles in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, is individuals who are claiming that they were Jews or Israelites and they weren't, and all this kind of fighting. So everybody wants to lie and say, yeah, I'm part of you too, so I get my part of it. Or the ones who want to claim that they were legitimate children of Aaron, of the Levites, and therefore they had a right to hold an office as a priest in the temple. No, no, no. You had to be a legitimate family heir coming down from Aaron and his specific line if you were going to do the service in the temple. And there was a lot of fighting, ones who wanted to claim that they were when they weren't. So it makes sense that God would have preserved a family tree record. That appears, I think that's a pretty good argument for what the purpose of 1st and 2nd Chronicles was. Now, it does duplicate the storylines, especially in 1st and 2nd Kings, but only basically in order to line up all of these families and their descendants through the events of the different kings. So I think it makes perfect sense why you've got duplicate stories. They're written for a different reason, but it all comes from God. Okay, what else do we know? All right, now this gets us to the question of who wrote the book of Samuel, the books of Samuel. Well, it's got his name on it, so it was him, right? The problem is, Samuel dies in the storyline in the book of 1 Samuel. So unless you think Samuel was writing from beyond the grave to finish that book plus 2 Samuel, there has to be another answer. Also, a citation from Adam Clark. Just to give you a background, his commentary says, the Jews in general believe that Samuel is the author of the first 27 chapters of the book of 1 Samuel, which contain the history of his own life and his government, meaning when he was appointed as a judge, and also of what respects Saul and David then had during that time, meaning the exploits of Saul and David during the lifetime of Samuel. So who knows for certain, but it makes perfect sense then those first 27 chapters, which are an account during the life of Samuel, very likely were written by Samuel himself. The remaining four chapters of 1 Samuel, the question is, well, Samuel's dead. Then who wrote about these events after Samuel's death? Well, the scholars suppose they were added in particular by two particular prophets of God, one named Gad and one named Nathan. Now, where did they get that? Well, there's actually a text. Let's turn to 1 Chronicles 29, 29. In 1 Chronicles 29, and beginning in verse 29, we read, "Now the acts of David the king, first and last, behold, they are written in the book of Samuel the seer." Now, if you're like me, when I was young and trying to read, you know, these books of the Bible, and I would say in Chronicles a reference to the books of Samuel the seer, I just thought they were talking about 1st, 2nd Chronicles. Not so. But there was a book called the Book of Samuel the Seer. It says so right here. And what else? They are written, so this is talking about the life and times of David. And here we find, if it's Ezra who is the one that God is inspiring to write this down, says they are written in the book of Samuel the seer and in the book of Nathan the prophet. Did you know there was a book called the Book of Nathan the prophet? Do you know where it is? Me either, because we don't have it. But it existed at the time. And so where did the books of Samuel come from? A book called the Book of Samuel the seer, and in the book of Nathan the prophet, and here's another one, and in the book of Gad the seer. Three different sources, apparently, that God preserved and then used, from which the book of 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel were compiled. Verse 30, "With all his reign," speaking of David, "and his might, and the times that went over him and over Israel and over all the kingdoms of the countries." Okay, so here God did choose to preserve a little bit of behind the scenes information about how some of these books came into being. So here we find this reference to the book of Samuel the seer. It's not, and it can't be our book of 1 Samuel, because again, the book of Samuel the seer was written by Samuel. But did a majority, if not the entirety of information from the book of Samuel the seer end up being those first 27 chapters of 1 Samuel? Very likely. Was Ezra inspired as the, because it's also speculated that Ezra was the one who compiled the books of 1 and 2 Samuel. Again, it's a question we don't have a definitive answer to. Somebody appointed by God, inspired by God, compiled those books. Okay? So it's speculated that Ezra did that too. But then the question is, how did Ezra do it when he lived, you know, hundreds of years after these events? Because God preserved inspired writings of the men who were witnesses in the day. And then a scribe like Ezra put together our modern day books from those older inspired works. And that's how we got them. And that's how we have confidence that they really were the words of God and not just made up by a man based upon ancient lore. This, by the way, is the very same way that the first five books of the Bible had to have been put together. So the first five books of the Bible are attributed to Moses: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. But wait a minute. Moses lived like 2,600 years after Adam. How is Moses now writing an account for what happened at the beginning of creation and in the Garden of Eden? How would you or I write something, a story, a credible story about something that happened 2,600 years ago? Well, you're going to have the inspiration of someone who's credible, right? Well, we were always taught, and again, it's not my intent to go through that, that there were inspired books that God preserved through antiquity and must have come down through the flood through Noah and came down ultimately into the hands of Moses with those firsthand accounts, which then God inspired Moses to put down according to God's very specific instruction to become the books that we have, including Genesis, let alone Exodus, of which Moses himself was a witness, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Okay? But some, if you believe that Genesis is inspired by God, you got to have some sort of explanation about how it got put together into a book. Moses is the one that's given credit for having, and they are called the books of Moses. So it's no different from these later ones we're talking about now with a later scribe inspired by God who literally compiled the storylines from past generations hundreds of years before he actually lived. So that's why I don't have a problem at all with believing it's very credible that Ezra or some other appointed man that God picked then did this work to give us the real truth of those stories. Let me give you, there's a list of, you may not have ever known this, 10 specific inspired books referenced in the Bible that do not exist today. Let me give you a quick summary. I just think it's kind of interesting. The first one is called, have you ever heard of the Book of the Wars of the Lord? It's referenced in Numbers 21:14. I'm not going to turn to these. Look them up yourself. There literally was an inspired book by God called the Book of the Wars of the Lord. The scholars think this book contained records of the wars of Israel. Wouldn't we love to have that? I mean, wouldn't you love to have more details about specific wars and battles that took place? God didn't choose to preserve those inspired books. He preserved them as long as they were needed, and then he allowed them literally to be extinguished. Here's another one you've read about, the Book of Jasher. You've heard of the Book of Jasher. We know it was a real book because it's mentioned in Joshua 10, verse 13. The Book of Jasher is also mentioned in 2 Samuel 1:18. Where's the Book of Jasher today? It's not here. But it existed in the day, and it was an inspired book by God which told the real history, used by these men who then compiled those history into our Bible. The scholars say that this Book of Jasher was likely a collection of poetry or possibly historical records. Here's another one. How about the book of Chronicles of the Kings of Israel and the Book of Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? Well, that kind of sounds like the, you know, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, but it wasn't. These are books specifically referenced, but again, are different from the books that we have today. Here's one called the Acts of Solomon. The Acts of Solomon mentioned in 1 Kings 11:41. Have you ever read the book, a book called the Acts of Solomon? I haven't. But it's referenced. It used to exist. 1 Kings 11:41. This, the scholars say, would have detailed events and wisdom of King Solomon not covered in the books that we have. Not in Samuel. Not in Ecclesiastes. A lot of additional stories God did not consider relevant to bring down to us. One day, if you get born into the God family, you're going to have all of that history. Here's another one that we've already referred to, Chronicles of Samuel the Seer, Chronicles of Nathan the Prophet, and Chronicles of Gad the Seer. Again, all referenced in 1 Chronicles 29:29, which we read as a source for information about the life of King David. We don't have those books, but we've got the books that God brought to us that tell portions of those stories. There's another book called Prophecy of Ahijah, the Silonite, and Visions of Iddo the Seer. Ever read those? They're noted in 2 Chronicles 9:29, supposedly giving additional accounts of Solomon's reign. There's also a book called the Book of Shemaiah, the Prophet, and the Book of Iddo the Seer, also mentioned in 2 Chronicles 12:15 regarding the acts of King Rehoboam. Number 8 is a book called The Story of the Prophet Iddo, referenced in 2 Chronicles 13:22 concerning the acts of King Abijah in particular. And then there's one called the Book of Jehu. The Book of Jehu, son of Hanani, cited in 2 Chronicles 20:34 concerning the acts of King Jehoshaphat. Now, when I read those stories that we have in 1 Kings and 2 Kings, you know, with references like, isn't it documented in the book of the Kings? I always thought, okay, 1 Kings or 2 Kings. No. They're literally referring to books that existed at the time that also had king in the name, but not the books we call 1 Kings and 2 Kings. But they were real books, inspired books of God that the chroniclers used in the day to copy from, if you will, to build the final books that God brought down to us. And number 10 is a book called Laments of Jeremiah. Oh, isn't that the book of Lamentations? It's mentioned, this is a book mentioned in 2 Chronicles 35:25. But a lot of scholars believe this likely refers to laments composed by Jeremiah for King Josiah and are distinct from our book of Lamentations. Again, a book that existed, was inspired by God, but God did not choose to bring down to us. I suspect that a lot of these books contain stories, detailed information that God intentionally did not want us to know. Need to know only. But they were the source material for the compiling of many of these historical books that we have today. So that's probably more information than you wanted. I get that. But I just want to give a context before we wade into the specific story so you have a kind of an umbrella understanding of how God might have used these different inspired men to actually put together the books that we know came from him. Last item concerning the origin of 1 and 2 Samuel in particular, because that's going to be our focus. Here's another citation which I think is pretty good. Adam Clark quotes Augustine Calmet concerning analysis of some of the statements made in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel that give you a little bit of additional historical information. Who was Calmet? Well, he was actually a 15th century Catholic monk. But he was one of those biblical scholars who documented a lot of stuff, and people give him somewhat credit. We take, you know, all of those scholars with a grain of salt. But Clark thinks there's some valuable things in quoting Calmet's analysis. So here, I'll just read you a few of these. These books of 1 and 2 Samuel contain remarks or expressions which could only proceed from a contemporary author, and certain others which are evidence of a much later age. So what Calmet's trying to do is show that within the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, there's evidence of more than one author. And I think that's pretty easy for you to derive from your own study. But Calmet kind of put it in a succinct list of five things. Number one, he says, for instance, we read in 1 Samuel 3:1, the word of the eternal, the word of the Lord was precious in those days. There was no open vision, i.e. in the days of Eli, the prophet, which we're going to read about, the high priest. Hence, it is evident that the author is writing about a time that apparently is not his time. He's saying in those days, there was no open vision. So he concludes the author lived in times in which prophecy was more common, which in fact did occur after the life of Samuel, or after Samuel and under David and the succeeding kings of Israel and Judah. Maybe not, speculation, but something to consider. Point number two, Calmet says, again, in the times of the author of this book, 1 Samuel in particular, the city of Bethel was called actually Bethaven, same town, but had a different name ascribed to it. And 1 Samuel 13:5 references that, which name, Calmet says, was given to it in derision after Jeroboam had placed there his golden calves. Okay, what's the point? The fact in the storyline concerning the days of Samuel, whoever compiled 1 Samuel gave that town a name that didn't even exist until hundreds of years later, in the reign of after the rebellion of King Jeroboam, because the name of that town was changed. And yet, instead of the original name of that town in the days of Samuel being used, the later one, hundreds of years later, was used to put in the Chronicles and Samuel. Okay, I think that might be compelling. Number three, again, it is said, 1 Samuel 6, verse 18, that the ark of the Lord was set down in the field of Joshua the Bethshemite, where it remained. And this is how it's phrased, and we'll read this in the story, so I won't make you turn to it. But 1 Samuel 6, 18 says, where it, the ark, remained to the time of this author. That's pretty compelling that this wasn't somebody who lived in the days when these events were taking place in the life of Samuel. It was a chronicler that got inspired many years later to write the story. And yet, in 1 Samuel 7:15, the writer speaks of Samuel as being already dead. So again, there has to be a second. Can't just be Samuel. And Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. Okay, point number four. This one I really take exception with, but just for comparison and how to look at stuff that so-called Bible scholars might tell you so you use a jaundiced eye. Calmet says, it is not natural to suppose that Samuel would have spoken of himself, as is done in 1 Samuel 2, verse 26, which says, the child Samuel grew and was in favor both with the Lord and with men. In other words, Calmet thinks, Samuel, that would be kind of a cheeky thing to write such positive going things about yourself. Not if God is the one inspiring it. Again, who wrote these books? Who wrote every word that we have in every one of these books? Either as a contemporary or as a chronicler whom God inspired from past inspired works to put together in an inspired fashion. God did. So, you know, this is concerning the childhood of Samuel. I do not rule out at all that God literally inspired the prophet Samuel to write about himself. The child Samuel grew and was in favor both with the Lord and with men. If that's what God told him to write, that's what Samuel wrote. If it was put by another inspired man generations later, fine. But I think that's a very weak argument. But point number five of Calmet is, in 1 Samuel 27, verse 6, it is said that Achish gave a Ziklag to David. Wherefore, Ziklag pertaineth to the kings of Judah unto this day. So somebody who's writing these final chapters in 1 Samuel are referring to the kings of Judah, which didn't exist until long after not only David, but after his son Solomon were dead. And yet here in 1 Samuel is a reference to the kings of Judah. So Calmet says, this is proof that when this book was written, the kingdoms of Judah and Israel were separated, and that although the tribe of Simeon belonged to the king of Israel, yet Ziklag, which was in that tribe, remained in the hands of the kings of Judah. So a lot of technical mumbo jumbo. It's not important, except for, again, I want to give you the gist of the fact that the way that God inspired for these books to be written, compiled, and preserved, then certainly had his special intervention all the way down the line, regardless of which individual he used literally to compile it. So, with that overview of what I'm calling the books of the kings, the next time we'll actually get into our analysis of 1 Samuel, otherwise called the first book of the kings, with the recorded life of Samuel the prophet himself.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented the first message in a new series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, December 21st, 2024.